Hello and welcome to Sustain, the podcast where we talk about sustaining open source for the long haul. Who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? How can we nail these boards together? I don't know. Does anyone know? Anyone know a carpenter? Very excited to talk to our guest today. Before I introduce her, I want to make sure you know who I am, because obviously I'm also on this podcast. I'm Richard Littauer. I'm your normal host. Very excited also to talk to our guest, Carrie L. Jordan. Carrie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. And it's hilarious that you mentioned carpenter, considering the organization I'm representing, the carpentry. We get asked all the time if we teach carpentry as in woodwork. We do not. But hello, Richard.
I think that should change. I think if we're talking about maintainer burnout and ways to engage PhD students who don't have other job prospects, we should really just every now and then have an honest trade lesson. Come to the workshop and in the workshop.
How you learn.
I would think that. Oh, okay. That's right. Carrie is, of course, the executive director for the Carpentries. Carrie is a doctor as well. She got her PhD in engineering education at Mishtech. Does it ever be called Mishtech, or is it always Michigan Tech? I guess it's always Michigan Tech.
I did my PhD at The Ohio State University, but I did my undergrad and master's at Michigan Tech. Yes.
Excellent. Thank you so much for clarifying. In any event, very well learned, has a PhD, is a scientist. Why is that important? Well, because of what the Carpentries does. If you haven't listened to any of our previous podcasts, we just had on Shani, who is also a member of the Carpentries in Buenos Aires in Argentina. Carrie, can you tell me a bit about what the Carpentries does? What's your elevator pitch?
Shout out to you, Richard, though, for that lovely accent, the way you pronounce Buenos Aires. That was phenomenal. Also, shout out to Shani. She is a wonderful community member and member of our board of directors for the Carpentries. The Carpentries is the leading inclusive community teaching data and coding skills. That's our vision, but it's also who we are. That's my elevator pitch. If you want to learn how to teach data science, if you want to do data science and do it in a way that is accessible, come to the Carpentries. If you want to learn how to use open source tools, if you want to learn open source perspectives, come to the Carpentries. We have, in my opinion, one of the best communities to learn, to make mistakes, to grow. And I'm grateful for this community. And I'm grateful that we exist within the open source ecosphere.
So I know that the Carpentries is normally something that's associated with academia. This podcast, of course, is focused with much broader than that, with all of open source tech as a whole. I have this one very pointed question. Is there anything that the Carpentries does or teaches that is not open source?
I love that question, because do you think that setting up a data management strategy is an open source topic?
Yeah.
I do too. But some, depending on if you are in academia or if you're in industry or if you're a nonprofit, some may say, well, that's not open source. Just teach me how to code or teach me how to use GitHub, right? So I think it really does depend on your stance in this open source world. I would say we teach all things open source, from how to manage a open source community to how to create open source lesson material, what things you should think about in terms of your infrastructure, code of conduct. All of these things to me matter when you're talking about building an open source project and then building a community that's going to use and maintain the open source project. So yes, I think we do it all. And if we don't do it, we know a lot of other communities that do wonderful things as well. And we kind of point you in the right direction.
That's interesting. Can you tell me what the adjacent communities are that you work with most often?
Absolutely. One such community is our OpenSci, and I'm sure Shani spoke a lot about that. You have to go listen to that episode if you want to learn about our OpenSci. Another community is the Center for Scientific Collaboration and Community Engagement, CSCCE. And they're a community that helps us learn about community management for open source. So those are two communities that we interact with a lot, we work with, and there are a ton of others as well.
So I know that the Carpentries in general is an incredibly well-funded organization. You're funded by the governments of the EU, the UK, and the US and Canada, each of them giving millions of dollars so every single person in the Carpentries is fully paid and that there are no volunteers in the entire stack. How do you manage that?
Richard is lying.
Sorry. I had to try. Tell me how you fund your work.
I wish you could see my face, listeners, because Richard is just really selling it. That is not at all. So we have a couple of different funding streams. We have what's called a membership program. And you spoke about us being sort of academic adjacent. We're adjacent to academia, and that's true. We have nearly 100 member organizations from universities in the US, labs, things like that. And they pay a membership to the Carpentries, and then they have priority access into different training programs and workshops. We've also received funding from a few foundations, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, the Sloan Foundation, the Moore Foundation, et cetera. And those funding opportunities came for specific projects. And then, of course, people can donate to the Carpentries, and you're welcome to do that. So, yes, a lot very diverse ways that we're funded, but our volunteers who are not paid are the reason our organization is so successful. And it's continuing to grow. We've supported workshops in over 64 countries. And again, it's because of our volunteers. Shout out to our volunteers. If you're a Carpentries instructor, thank you. If you're a maintainer, if you are a lesson developer, thank you, thank you, thank you. And of course, I would love to shout out my beautiful core team as well. We have a team of 9 paid staff that support the thousands of instructors and maintainers and all of that.
So in terms of the constellation of fiscal entities within open source, is our OpenSci fundamentally a host for a workshop? Is it a fiscal host, or is it more just a community support group where you help out all of these volunteers doing all the work? Or do you have research that you do? Or do you provide some sort of contracting in the RSE, research software engineer world? How do you split up those 9 people's time?
We separate our work. Our team is very cross-collaborative. So don't get me wrong. When I say separate, it's more so from a programming perspective. So we have a team that focuses on our curricula. We have a team that focuses on workshops and instruction. And then we have a team that focuses on community engagement overall. And so these 9 individuals sit on 1 to 2 teams focused on those things, ensuring that our curricula are high quality and that we're continuing to see new lessons in our lab and in our incubator, and ensuring that the lessons that are stable, that our maintainers and our lesson program governance is talking about how to keep those lessons current. And then we have another program area that looks at running workshops and instructor training. And then lastly, the community engagement piece. So that's kind of how we think about structuring our work as staff, and also how we think about supporting the larger Carpentries community.
So when I think about our OpenSci or the Carpentries or any of these sort of pro-tool, pro-workshop communities, I always wonder, what's success for you, right? Is it everyone becoming a core maintainer on a project themselves and then going on to land tenure jobs? Is it everyone leaving the academic industry and joining a hedge fund as a quant? What are you aiming for in terms of serving your communities?
We want to build global capacity in essential data skills. We want individuals who have data or who are impacted to use data to their advantage in the ways that make sense for them or their community. We know that decisions that impact our lives are made with data. And speaking as a woman of color who grew up in Detroit, having lots of decisions made for me, as I matriculated through school and getting my PhD and all of that, it became more apparent to me that I needed to be a decision maker. I wanted to be someone who made those kinds of decisions, which means I need to know, if I'm going to walk the walk, I need to know how to talk the talk. I need to be able to understand what data is, how to use it, how to make decisions, how to use it in ways that will positively impact my community. And so for the Carpentries, ultimately, if we have achieved our mission, we won't exist because everyone will have data skills and they'll know how to use data to make informed decisions. We still exist because there are hosts of people in communities who don't have access to open source tools, who have never heard of Richard. Before I came on staff at the Carpentries, I had never heard of R, Python. I had never heard of GitHub. I have never heard, and I have a PhD. So there's a lot to be said about access and spreading these skills and spreading the perspectives around open source. So if the Carpentries no longer exist, we've done our job. But I think that we're a long way from there.
But it's a good goal. I'm sorry to hear that. I'm glad you know about those tools now.
Thank you so much.
In today's environment, we're seeing a lot of data decisions leading towards negative outcomes for our society. Simple example, Bitcoin is an interesting idea. Some of the follow-up coins have a lot of potential, but Bitcoin itself is an unnecessary waste on the environment. Everyone knows it, and it's only where it is because it was the first, right? If we could all be Ethereum, we'd all be on Ethereum, but we're not. We still have Bitcoin. So that sucks. What does the Carpentries do to help inform users about how to use data well instead of just what methods to use when you're trying to learn about the data that you're working with? How do you help people make ethical decisions about what to do with their work?
I love that question. Are you familiar with the FAIR principles?
I am. They are really awesome.
So for those who are not familiar, there are principles for scientific data management and stewardship that can be applied beyond data and open source. And the acronym is FAIR, F-A-I-R, findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. And those principles underscore a lot of the curricula that we teach. We talk a lot about equity and inclusion at the Carpentries. We talk a lot about accessibility. If you are running an open source project, but the general public can't find your project, or maybe we found it, but I can't fork your repository and tweak it a little bit for my purposes. I really love what you're doing, but in my community, maybe it's because English isn't my first language or a myriad of other reasons, I can't reuse your project, then we're not doing a good job of spreading data skills. And so I think that's one area where the Carpentries has done well, sort of applying these principles, not only in the curricula, but also in the other resources that we create, ensuring that we're not only creating resources, but are they findable? Can someone take this resource and do a little bit of tweaking to make it better for their local community? I think that's super important too.
What's interesting about what you point out, the FAIR principles, which are excellent, they work really well for data. Data is, of course, differently licensed than code, right? Open source code is not the same as open source data. There is increasingly less of a distinction between them because data means nothing now without also having the files that you need to manipulate and deal with whatever format's in. But the second principle in the OSD, the open source definition by which we judge open source licenses, is that the source code has to be available, has to be well publicized, which I think the FAIR people were looking at when they were underneath their giant big tent canvas. Maybe we should copy that one. So I agree, and I think that's great. And I'm glad that you're teaching all the people who go through your workshops about that principle.
Yeah.
Kind of leads to my next question, which is, it's awesome to have principles by which you deal with your data, and it's awesome to teach those to people. But one of the things that's difficult around open source is that you can use as much as you want, but if you don't contribute back, it doesn't necessarily help the people who you took it from.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you tell me how the Carpentries deals with that, seeing as how all the work that you're working on is standing on the shoulders of giants who've already contributed stuff before?
Yes. A big part of that is a recognition and appreciation. And I have to, once again, I'm always going to shout out the individuals who work so hard in the space. So I want to give a big shout out to Dr. Alicia Crawl. She's currently the director of community at CSBCE, which is the organization I mentioned earlier. She did so much work for the Carpentries to help us develop a strategy to recognize the contributions to the Carpentries as an open source project, whether it was contributing to our lessons, contributing to the actual infrastructure, or teaching a workshop, right? Recognizing and incentivizing, I think those two topics are difficult because it depends. Appreciation looks different. It can look different depending on what's important to you. Some people would prefer a LinkedIn badge or maybe a certificate or something that they can show to an employer. Some people would prefer if they contributed to an open source project or some code or something like that, a DOI that says, I did this thing, right? And so I think as leaders in this space, having more conversations about the recognition and appreciation and then incentivizing, it can look different. Some people need to get paid because they live in areas where they don't. It's an equity issue, right? People who have time and have resources have time to contribute to open source. Some people who they're working two jobs, they have a family, they don't have time to contribute, right? And so I think those are the kinds of conversations we really need to have. How do we recognize contributors, appreciate them in the ways that are helpful for either their careers or whatever is important to them? And then what can incentives look like that are actually sustainable? We can't pay everybody. We can't pay you per pull request. But, you know, what can we do?
I like what you say about incentives and that appreciation is different depending on what works for you. Some people want a DOI, some people want something else. A lot of times I put the data people in my head in one group and then the open source people in my head in another group. And sometimes there's some people walking between the groups. Most of the time they're kind of in their own little camps having a good party.
Yeah.
I wonder, is that the same for you? And do you find that it's difficult to lead the data people to the open source water and have them make PRs back and have them become open source maintainers because they see themselves as dataists as opposed to coders?
Richard, you better come through with a question. This is a great question. This is a phenomenal question. The answer is sometimes. We do have a segment of our community that plays in the gray, right? They like to dabble in both the data and also the maintenance of whether it's our infrastructure. But by and large, people come into the community, maybe they took a workshop and they're like, in general, this community is pretty cool. Let me see what other things I can do. And they kind of pick a side. I want to teach. I'm going to focus on that. Or I really love the R lesson. So I'm going to focus on the lesson development pathway. Few people play in the gray, but yeah, it really does seem like people have their favorite sub-community or however you want to describe that. But I think that's fine. If you know where your strengths are, you know where your passion is, as long as we onboard you properly, I think that's a huge, I'm sure at some point we'll talk about onboarding and offboarding to prevent burnout. We can't have these indefinite roles in open source. But as long as you onboard people properly, you train them, you show them how to offboard, it's okay to say, I want to be a data person, or I'm going to stick to contributing to the infrastructure. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
You don't think that having a large group of people who use open source without ever contributing back because in their head they see themselves as data people helps contribute to the burnout of the open source maintainers working on those packages? I would see that as being correlated. Maybe that's not causation, but I'm just curious about your thoughts on that.
You're right. It is correlated. And this is just my experience at the Carpentry. What I've noticed is that those who are the data people a lot of them don't have confidence that their contributions are worthwhile.
Yeah.
And so they kind of decide, well, I took the workshop. It was great. I don't see anything wrong. What could I possibly contribute? I'm not a subject matter expert, right? And so I think there might be an opportunity to kind of educate them on the worthwhileness of their contributions. And even from a values perspective, one of our Carpentry's core values is we value all contributions. So even if it's a pull request that is fixing a typo, your contribution matters. So I think you're right. It's important to give back, but I think it's an opportunity for us to educate them that, yes, your contributions do matter.
I attended the Carpentry's workshop a couple of months ago in February in Wellington, New Zealand. And at one point, the person who was giving the workshop said, all of you who are here, you're all members of our community, whether you know it or not. And that made me wonder, what if I was the janitor? What if I just wandered and threw him off the street, right? How do I know? And so your statement, all contributions matter. Can I push you to give me a discriminant function that tells me like what really is in the Carpentry's and what isn't? I'm not saying, by the way, that janitors aren't a worthy trade. 100%, they're the best people in the world. I'm just saying that there may not necessarily be data scientists, right? The Carpentry's may not work for them. So yeah, I'm just curious, how do you tell that all contributions matter? Was that intentional language? What were you trying to get at there?
Yeah, let me actually read the value to it because there is something to that as long as they abide by our code of conduct, right? So I'm going to share the come on now. As long as. So the statement reads, we value all contributions by individuals and entities to our community, code, lessons, and broader ecosystem, as long as those contributions adhere to the Carpentry's code of conduct. So to your point, yes, contributions to our code, our lessons, the broader ecosystem. Yeah, we do describe it a little bit more plainly than, yeah, we take all your contributions.
Okay. And I'm sorry to just be really curious about that point.
No, I love it. We should be able to justify our inclusiveness, right? And really describe what it means.
Totally agree. And I think one of the things I'm getting at when I'm asking that question, you mentioned earlier, Carpentry's ideally shouldn't exist. Got a lot of work left to do.
Yeah.
What is your 20-year vision? What's your 50-year vision for the Carpentry's? Where do you want it to be in a realistic sense? Not in a, it's disappeared, mm-hmm. everyone wins, luxury, gay, yeah. European communism. But what is it really for you?
Our lessons are being taught in hundreds of languages. Right now, our lessons are primarily taught in English. We have a beautiful community that has translated our lessons to Spanish, Korean, different languages. We have a multilingual open source glossary called Glossario. I'll share that with you so that your listeners can check it out, of course. But 20 years from now, we have lessons in hundreds of languages. Individuals are teaching Carpentry workshops in their mother tongue. It's not necessarily reliant on a strong internet connection. Right now, in order for the Carpentry to work well in your community, you have to have a laptop. You have to have a strong Wi-Fi connection. And in some communities, these things just don't exist. So are there ways we can spread the Carpentry's and our lessons that don't rely on necessarily having a strong internet connection? Can I teach my Carpentry's lesson in Afrikaans easily? I think that's where we need to go. And then I mentioned capacity building earlier. Our entire model is built off of this model of training the trainer. I'm going to come in and I'm going to teach 25 people how to do something. And those 25 people are going to go and they're going to teach another. And it continues to grow and spread. We thrive because of that model. We don't do any marketing. We are a word of mouth, nonprofit open source project, right? And so I see that model still working 20 years from now where someone took a workshop and then they went and told someone and they continue to spread the word.
I love this. Longtime listeners will know that multiple languages is one of the things that I'm always pressing people on. That is, you're not inclusive if it's not in everything else. It's awesome to see Xhosa on this list. That is the coolest. Going from there, one of the longstanding jokes that I have, at least, is that all sustainability problems with open source are actually just problems with capitalism. If they solve capitalism, it all goes away. Hooray! There's no issue.
Oh, you're not wrong.
Without going down that direction, which we could do, but we both understand, what's really difficult for you besides, say, having Glossario up? What's the hardest part about your job in terms of making sure that it sustains itself and that you help out the wider ecosystem as a whole? Is it allocating resources for workshops need to run? Is it getting funding? What is it?
It's funny that you mentioned those two things, because from an organizational priorities perspective, our focus this year is volunteer capacity and revenue generation. I'm like,
yeah.
Were you in the staff meeting, Richard? What's going on here? But it's true, because there was a time, so I've been executive director, I'm going into my fifth year now. Pandemic, everyone wanted to fund equity and inclusion and open source. It was like, I could write a grant and pull in $750,000, right? Since that time, many things have shifted. Many things have shifted. But a lot of the attention is on AI, machine learning, what's super hot right now. The Carpentries teach fundamental data skills. You need fundamental data skills in order to do many of the other things. And so we don't want to shift, and we're not going to, as long as I'm executive director, we're not going to shift our focus away from our mission in order to chase what's being funded. So we have had some challenges with revenue generation. We've streamlined things a lot to really hone in on what's critical to our mission. But yes, also from a volunteer capacity perspective, again, the pandemic really forced us all to look at our lives and all of the different things that we do and trim the fat and focus on what's essential. And that has meant a decrease in involvement from many of our longtime volunteers. People are really looking at their lives and saying, I don't think I have time to do this. I don't think I have time to volunteer in these ways. And so those are the two things that are at the top of my mind. But it's not doom and gloom. Don't get me wrong. We have new community members joining the Carpentries every week, every single week. And it's just a matter of onboarding them properly so that they don't get overwhelmed by all the great things that there are to do in the community, and engaging them. Yeah.
Heard about the downturn since the pandemic from that perspective. I know there's been the tech layoffs, and I know there's the AI hype, and those are fads, but what isn't a fad, right? Civilization's a fad. So one of the problems with talking with executive directors,
yes,
is that they're so keyed in on their mission statement that for you, the Carpentries is the most important thing in the world, because it's got to be, right? That's what you get your bread and butter on, and you got to be good at proving that with other people. Otherwise, you're not very good at your job.
Yeah.
I've tried this question before, but I kind of want to ask you, if tomorrow it turned out for reasons that were not malicious, but you just had to go do something else on open source, where would you try and work and what would you try and do? What problem would you try to solve?
Within open source or outside?
In the open space, in the space of open source. What else do you think is really relevant that we're not paying enough attention to? Because I know that you care about data science and FAIR principles and DEI and STEM. I get that. I'm just curious, what would you do to solve those problems if it wasn't from the Carpentries?
I would focus all of my attention on equity and inclusion, if I could. Right now, because the Carpentries is a global nonprofit, I'm very passionate about access and equity and inclusion, but it looks, equity and diversity and inclusion, it looks different depending on what country you live in, right? Here where we live in the United States, we talk a lot about people of color, Black and brown, Indigenous. But if you live in the Netherlands, for example, it's totally different. Equity and inclusion means something totally different if you live in Thailand, right? And so for that reason, I'm not able to really hone in on a particular Black people in STEM, for example. If I were not at the Carpentries, I would probably focus on, within the United States, pulling more people of color into open source communities, because it would make such a huge impact in our local communities and some of the tribal communities. I think that's where I would be solving problems with open source, specifically for people of color across the United States.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And where you're coming from, it also makes sense. My ex-girlfriend always used to laugh at the term BIPOC, because in Britain, it didn't make any sense to her. It's like, who are the indigenous? The Scots? I'm Scottish. Does that make me indigenous? Like, who knows?
See?
It's a really interesting question. I wonder around that in terms of access to open source technologies. Obviously, if you're Norwegian, it's a whole lot easier because there's less income disparity, right? There's other issues in Norway or any Scandinavian country, but there's not the same issues like, do I have access to a computer at a library,
correct,
right? Whereas here, do we have a library is now a contentious question.
Yes.
So I like your answer. It makes a lot of sense to me. I also think it really fits with the fact that you seem to be focusing a lot at the Carpentries on languages. Languages are one of the sine qua nons, that's in Latin, sorry, one of the things without which you can't do.
Now I know
coding,
what that means.
Right? Yeah. So I really like that. Can you tell me one thing that you're really excited about coming up in the future as we wind down our questions, because we're running up on time?
I'm excited about potential collaboration. So up until this time, we collaborate with all kinds of, I'll just call it organizations, institutions, right? We collaborate with universities. We collaborate with other open source projects. We collaborate with funders outside of doing grants and things like that. But I wouldn't say we've had a true strategy, and one that we haven't really formed like an alliance with another organization that says, we are going to share our resources so that both of our organizations can thrive. And we're going to work on that this year. We're going to work on identifying 1 to 2 organizations that we can form a strategic alliance with, where we are going to share resources so that both of our communities can thrive and can grow from a volunteer capacity perspective or generating revenue together. That's something that I'm really excited about. Something else I'm excited about is the resources that we're creating for communities to run their own events. Inclusive meetings of open source practitioners is something that's super important for us. And so we created some resources to help people who are trying to run online meetings or even in-person meetings and make them more accessible. So we're sharing out some resources that should help that as well.
That's awesome and exciting. I'm looking forward to that. Carrie, where can people follow you online besides the Carpentries, which you can obviously go to carpentries.org?
Yes, I'm on Mastodon, Dr. Carrie L. Jordan. Also on GitHub, Carrie L. Jordan. Everywhere, Carrie L. Jordan. I have to include my middle initial. That way you know it's me.
And that's Carrie, K-A-R-I.
That's right.
Carrie, thank you so much for coming on. It's been really awesome to be able to talk to you and to talk about the Carpentries at length. Again, I love talking about the Carpentries. It's super, super awesome. Huge soft spot in my heart for all academics.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Don't leave yet, however. Now is the time of the show where we do spotlights. Spotlights where we point out other people, projects, or things, or dogs, children, chameleons, which have helped us out in our lives and led us to where we are today, without which we wouldn't be here. We're just giving back a bit, putting light on them. I always go first, and my spotlight today is Nisha Ghatak at NESI. That's at the New Zealand eScience Institute. They are super, super awesome. They're the people who organize the large supercomputing clusters in New Zealand, and Nisha was the person who ran 2 of the Carpentries workshops I was at. I also saw her later in Sydney, and she co-ran those, but Nisha stood out to me as one of the excellent people running the Carpentries workshop. So thank you so much, Nisha. You are awesome. Carrie, what's your spotlight today?
Open Refine. Thank you for existing. Listen, I did not know that Open Refine existed when I was getting my PhD over a decade ago. Open Refine is a very powerful, free open source tool for those of you who have never heard of it that helps you clean your messy data. I did all of my data cleaning by hand. It was awful. If you don't know what Open Refine is, look it up and then come and take a workshop with the Carpentries, because we teach Open Refine You can turn your messy data into beautifully formatted data that can go into something like R, Python. It's one of my favorite tools ever, and one that I wish I had known about when I was getting my doctorate.
Love that. Thank you. Listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this program. If you have those few things you can do, one, you can share it with your friends. That's really how the word gets out about this. So please let people know that you're listening to this podcast. Two, you can go on opencollective.com/sustainoss and donate monetarily if you like, or you can email us at richard@sustainoss.org or podcast@sustainoss.org. It goes to all the hosts, not just me. You can also go on Mastodon, you can go on Blue Sky or LinkedIn, and you can find us there on the socials. If you have thoughts, you can go on our discourse at discourse.sustainoss.org, which is super, super cool. And of course, you can always find the podcast and the show notes at podcast.sustainoss.org. where you can find the show notes for this episode, as well as Carrie's bio and outward links. Carrie, thank you so much for coming on. Good luck with everything. Good luck getting funding and building capacity with your volunteers this year. I think those are two excellent goals to work on. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks for having me. Thanks for listening.